For centuries, the United Kingdom, England, Wales, and Scotland have served as a source and a champion for Western culture and classical learning. Yet, much like here in the United States, the last 100 years have seen this slow drift towards utilitarian education, child-led models, and many have forgotten the true aim of education: to form the next generation to think deeply and to know and love and to pursue truth, ultimately leading to the flourishing of human beings. But a renewal is gaining quiet ground in England and Wales, with new schools being started and a grassroots effort to recover what was lost. It's a story worth hearing and one that will inspire you as a parent or school leader in your own community. All this and more on this episode of Basecamp Live.
Mountains, we all face them as we seek to influence the next generation. Get equipped to conquer the challenges, summit the peak, and shape exceptionally thoughtful, compassionate, and flourishing human beings. We call it Ancient Future Education for Raising the Next Generation. Welcome to Basecamp Live. Now your host, Davies Owens.
Welcome to yet another episode of Basecamp Live. You're here with Davies Owens, your host and founder of this journey that we're on of raising the next generation. I have had such a joy of late traveling around the country and getting to be on campuses at so many of your schools. It is a busy schedule, but it's one that's very rewarding. And as I'm looking ahead to 2026, I will be traveling a great deal. I'm getting to speak and to connect with many schools and be a part of sharing the Basecamp Live and Zipcast story. If you're interested in having me out to your school to speak to parents or teachers, educators, just check out the speaking tab there on the Basecamp Live website, along with many other places to find other episodes that we've had over the past 8 years. As always, info at Basecamp Live is a great way just to reach directly out to me. Several of you this week reached out to me after being curious about things you'd heard on various episodes, so always glad to answer questions and point you towards resources. This particular episode of Basecamp Live is possible thanks to our partners, Wilson Hill Academy, which is an amazing organization if you're looking for ways to have a classical education online for the whole school day, or maybe even just to supplement a class, as well as Life Architects Coaching, a great organization that helps guide young people and even adults towards understanding their aptitudes and their skills as they make decisions about colleges and life beyond. The Champion Group, which is a fantastic organization helping schools raise funds in very creative ways like Feed the Need. And then the Herzog Foundation, which offers amazing training resources around the country. I'm a coach with Herzog 4 or 5 times a year. We teach, one of the courses I do is on parent engagement. So check out the Herzog Foundation and join us. It's free for schools. It's really amazing for 2.5 day training. And then finally, our own Zipcast. We are in an exciting season with a new 2.0 platform up and running. We are going to be inviting a handful of schools. We have some room in the first part of next year, January, February, to jump on board just for the remainder of the school year. Just check out zipcast.media for more information there. My conversation with Jamie Burns is one that was incredibly inspiring. I love stories. We all do. And much of this is really just Jamie telling his story of his own journey as one who grew up there in the UK, and the contrast between the education that he was receiving and his public schools and what he was experiencing even in his own home. He ended up going down a path of education in the Teach First Leadership Development Program in Cardiff, and he has worked in both primary and secondary schools. But his story is one, I won't give it away here, you'll just have to listen to it, but his a remarkable discovery of classical Christian education here in the United States and its own renewal, and the impetus behind his deciding to go back and take on this incredibly ambitious goal of helping to revive classical education in the UK. He is a speaker with Society for Classical Learning at conferences, and he advises leaders in the movement. You're going to love this conversation with Jamie Burns. Let's jump right in. Jamie, welcome to Basecamp Live.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
It's always a joy to hear from folks that are outside of the US. We know that the classical Christian movement is alive and well around the world, and I had the joy of getting to know you. I guess we met a year ago, and then we reconnected at a CLT event. You had crossed over the pond, and I was hearing all these amazing stories about what God's been doing in your life and helping to advance education in the UK. And so I was like, I got to get Jamie on the podcast to tell his story. So let's jump right in. Tell folks a little bit about just your own educational journey, and help us, you know, understand kind of what God's doing there in your midst.
Thanks. Yeah, there are lots of threads to weave here, so you'll have to bear with me as I try to sew them out. I had a public school education, what you guys would call a public school education, famously, of course, not what we would call a public school education, but that's a story for another time. And it was a pretty average education. I graduated high school in 2010. And so it was sort of pre what we might consider the real progressive capture of those institutions, but certainly not pre a relativistic way of understanding all that it is that we should learn. And yet, simultaneously, whilst at home, was fortunate to be, firstly, one of six children, and so engaged in conversation regularly around the table, because that was a familial habit. But also, my father received what I would now call a classical Christian education. But of course, we didn't have the language to describe it, and neither did he. But he is of a generation where he went to an elite private school in England and got a classical Christian education in the 50s and 60s, and then went to Oxford, read greats, and so got a classical education at Oxford. And so our regular conversation around the table at home was very much one of getting the Greek lexicon out, or perhaps talking about some mythology, or even with scripture, and very, very intentionally, or perhaps unintentionally on his behalf, but it's all he knew, thinking about the normative value of what it is that we were reading and talking about, as opposed to the education I got at school, which was all about information and relativizing all that we could read. I remember being in a lesson, I mean, we were still studying great works, so we would talk about Macbeth in year nine, so that was eighth grade, we were reading Macbeth together, and I remember incredibly frustrated with the English teacher that we were learning about the impact that rain had rather than talking about Macbeth and his character.
Fascinating. You say rain, like the physical, weather
just
storm.
Let's talk about what the weather is. Why are we talking about that? There's far more interesting things to be talking about here.
And your father then would have, I mean, did he then pick up sort of the reading and then carried on at dinner? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. Those two things didn't interact. They were non-overlapping magisteria, perhaps, in my life, the home and the school. And I didn't click into this whatsoever. I went to university. Mm. I read mathematics and music as an undergraduate, which is somewhat ironically quadrivial, though I didn't realize at the time. Then, whilst at university, was due to go into the army. And was diagnosed with a form of epilepsy 1 year prior, so my junior year, I think. Is junior year for you the year prior to the penultimate year of university?
Correct.
Is that right? Great. Okay, yes, so my junior year.
Well, there's junior, and then there's senior, and then you have first year of university. So, yeah.
Okay, so the penultimate year of university then, whatever it would be, would be fine.
Yep.
I was diagnosed and, like I say, was very much set on becoming an officer in the army. That then fell through and I had this minor existential crisis of what is it that I do now? And had been fortunate enough to be playing sport to a reasonably high level and had done a bit of coaching in that time. And whilst I've been coaching, and we joked about this when we met in Annapolis, whilst I've been coaching, had been told that I'd make a good coach and had taken that somewhat offensively, as if they were saying you'd make a bad athlete and a good coach. I don't think they meant that, but it, you know, hit my pride a little bit. Anyway, remembered that. And then over the course of 4 weeks post the army making the decision that I was medically discharged and was not eligible, which of course is completely right. Over those 4 weeks, I had a number of people come to me and say, you should be a teacher. And each time I said, I cannot imagine anything worse than being a teacher. and the reason for that was I was a fairly intelligent boy who misbehaved egregiously whilst at school because probably I was bored or I was just rude and various reasons. I thought, you know, if I, as this person who has done reasonably well academically, behave that way, I dread to think what my teachers had to deal with for people who really actively misbehaved. I don't want that. Anyway, a set of people who I really, really valued their opinion of all over that 4-week period said you should be a teacher. And so I made a deal with God, as is our way as humans. And of course, is usually I imagine God sitting there laughing at us attempting to make bargains with him. But I made a deal and said, look, you know, if I get this grade for my university degree, then I will do teaching, because the only way I wanted to do it was through our equivalent of Teach for America, which is called Teach First. And lo and behold, that happened, and I got on to Teach First, and I went into teaching. And I was confronted when teaching with a little bit more maturity, though not much more than when I was 18 and leaving high school, but with a little bit more, with the same scenario that I had left of this relativistic educational perspective that is driven around things that, to my mind, are unimportant. And yet, with this extra 4 years, I could begin to name the things that I didn't like in a way that I couldn't when I was 16. You know, I mentioned that Macbeth story in eighth grade. I wouldn't have been able to say why it was that I was, you know, frustrated that we were talking about rain. I wouldn't have said, right. There's something in human flourishing to be taught through here. That would not have been anywhere near my mind. But it was uncomfortable to me because that was what I was used to at home.
Right.
And those were the two things that are rubbing against each other. And that was the thing that I began to realize whilst teaching for the first 2 years of my career, and began to be able to name. I could say, I actually think that saying something like, you know, why am I learning about Pythagoras' theorem? I was a maths teacher. That was my training. Why am I learning about Pythagoras' theorem, sir? And the response to that being, because if you're going to be an engineer, you need to know, you know, who cares? That's, what an awful answer. And frankly, who cares if you're
utilitarian? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But also the kids don't care about that kind of thing either. Because I'm not going to be an engineer, I'm going to be a bricklayer. Or that's so far away from where I am right now. Even if I wanted to be an engineer, that doesn't matter to me. And so all those things that I'd felt as a child and began to become a little bit more real. And I began to see the distinction between what went on in my home life and the way that we would think about literature and think about words and think about sentences and what we did in my school life, where none of that was present. And at this time as well, I was sort of coming into contact with a bit more of my parents' concordance with my school, and was seeing their dismay at the lack of homework that I got from school, or the grammar that I was being encouraged to write at school. And so that, you know, I could see that at the same time as discovering this tension, there was this tension there for them as well. And that was really interesting to me. Anyway, now going through my teaching career, so I've now done 2 years teaching in a school in Cardiff, which is in the capital of Wales. And then moved to South West England to continue teaching in our version of a charter school network. We call them multi-academy trusts, but it's essentially a charter school network. And was beginning to be able to articulate more and more of the things that made me feel uncomfortable about what I was doing. But at the same time, there were things that I felt uncomfortable about still and didn't have words for. And then in 2020, just as the COVID pandemic is really hitting and the schools are being shut down by government fiat, I was happily listening to the new podcast, The Rest is History, which of course is a wonderful podcast. And other than this one is the one that all the listeners should listen to for sure. Yeah. And Spotify's algorithm,
So no, Cohen. Yeah. I don't want to get ahead of the story because I know where you're going with this. Yeah. So it's Spotify's algorithm pulls up what?
Yeah. Right. Pulls up after listening to that, an Andrew Kern podcast. Mm-hmm. And I hear Andrew Kern talking about classical Christian education, and he puts words to the things that I still felt uncomfortable about and could not have articulated. And I think to myself, that is it. That is the thing that we have been missing. And that is the thing that I experienced a part of in my home, what he is talking about, contemplative. My father is a deeply contemplative man who has really understood that way of learning that I just didn't get at all, but it was modeled to me. So I took it upon myself to do whatever I could to discover this classical Christian renewal that is taking place in America. And that's the beginning of the journey into classical Christian.
It is such a, there's so many wonderful parts of this story, Jamie. Obviously the just the reminder of the power of a parent and things like simple dinner conversations and thoughtfully asked questions. But it formed in you an affection, a love, a desire for something of greater depth. And then you go out into the world and here's the purveyors of education, these institutions that are serving up, you know, this kind of tepid education. You're thinking it was way better at the dinner table. So along that journey, before you got to Andrew Kern's podcast, did you have conversations with your father, just kind of asking his opinion, especially if he saw what you were bringing home and had concerns?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I think the thing that's most amusing to me about, you said, the power of a parent, from in his perspective, it was all unintentional. None of the way that he did those things was a deliberate act of, I need to raise my child to understand what the great tradition has to say to him. It was just what he knew. That was the way that he had been brought up. And so he didn't know how to do what I was getting at school. There's some power in that, isn't there, of the impact that we have on our children just through the things that we model and the way that we live.
And to your point, he wasn't putting on anything. It's just, he had been formed. I mean, this again is the spirit we'll talk about behind what we do, is we're forming, the human soul to truly flourish. And when he was formed in that way, it just became who he was. He didn't know otherwise, which is part of the beautiful story. Well, we're going to get a break, but before we do, I want you to finish up a little bit of, you know, so now you find yourself, you now have words to define this, discovery. And you become, go from there. So then you just continue to lean in on this. And what did that lead to?
At that point, I'm working for this multi-academy trust in Charter School Network in South West England. And my wife at the same time falls pregnant with our first child. And that is the clincher for me. There is no way that I am allowing any of our children to go to any of the schools that I've ever worked in.
Wow.
Nor could we afford to send them to the uber elite schools, nor would we want to, frankly. They are in many ways even worse and more captured by what we would consider to be progressive ideology than some of our public schools are, our government schools.
Right.
And so out starts this vision of how can we bring the renewal of the last 40 years that has been taking place in the United States over to Great Britain, which of course sounds to the American ear like an absolutely ridiculous idea, because it's Britain and that's where classical education starts. And why is it not going on? It's not here. We've lost it.
It's such a sad realization, because we inherited this from you, if you will, and now you're inheriting it back, which is part of the fun and beautiful story. And we've seen that in the churches, you know, whether it's renewals that are coming out of Africa that are now impacting the Anglican Church or other churches here in the U.S. And so there you are now in a very, in a place that's come so far from where those roots were of classical education, you know, the home of Tolkien and Lewis and great thinkers, and the Clapham Group and others, certainly changed so much. This is probably a good place to pause, because I want to come back and hear a bit more, just give us really a state of where mainstream education, you've alluded to that, in the UK right now, and then talk about really what you've, looking around, as you've just acknowledged, there was no solution other than to simply hear God's call to step up and actually start this renewal movement. So it's quite a ambitious undertaking, and one that's sure fraught with challenges, but I want to hear more of the story. Why don't we take a break? We'll come right back and jump into more of your story. School leaders, if you have ever wondered how to make school fundraising truly effective while being meaningful and mission-driven, join us at Advance. It's an event that's being run by the good folks at the Champion Group. The Advance is an April 8th through 10th, 2026 event in Greensboro, North Carolina. And here's the best part. It's completely free to attend. You just have to cover travel and lodging. Advance is for heads of schools, board directors, and leaders who feel the pressure of raising big dollars without losing sight of their calling. At Advance, you're going to find tools and training and encouragement while connecting with peers from across the country, learning from top development experts, and leaving with real-world strategies that you can take home and use right away. Plus, every attendee receives a complimentary development evaluation and review. Spots are limited, so don't wait. Register today. The details are in the show notes for this episode. During this short break, I have a special invitation to all school leaders, administrators, and teachers. I want you to imagine for a moment stepping away from your everyday routine at school and diving deep into the rich foundations of Christian education. Surrounded by world-class scholars, seasoned classroom teachers, and administrative experts with years of experience running schools with a lot of wisdom to share. That's exactly what the Herzog Foundation's Institute is offering. I've had the joy of serving as a training coach for the last few years, leading their 2.5-day training on spiritual formation and another one on parent engagement. They offer close to 50 unique training events, ranging from board governance to marketing to classroom best practices. They even offer a training on how to teach the great books. And the best part of all, well, thanks to the generosity of the Herzog Foundation, these training events, including lodging, are completely free for Christian educators. Institutes are located around the country in beautiful locations, including at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., and the Reagan Library in Santa Barbara. Don't miss this incredible opportunity. Check out the details at theherzogfoundation.com. Jamie, we were saying right before the break, most of us have this very nostalgic view of the UK. Many have had the blessing of going over, and you walk through Oxford or Cambridge, or you see these architecturally beautiful buildings and Westminster Abbeys, and you think, boy, this is classical education must be everywhere here. It's not the case. In fact, you're probably further afield than even American public schools in some ways. Just give folks a sense of perspective on where education is and where the needs are as you have seen it.
It's quite an intricate story, really, in that there are some real positives from the last 15 years, and there are some things that are negatives. And so it's a story worth telling. And it's also worth separating out England, Scotland, and Wales independently, because just like states work for you, we have devolved powers. And one of those devolved powers for Wales and Scotland is education. And so what happens in Scotland and Wales is actually very different to what's happening in England right now. And so it's worth maybe teasing that out as well, I think, because that's an interesting part of the story. So I said I graduated high school in 2010. And that year, the Conservative government didn't quite win an election. They didn't quite get a majority, but they were able to form a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats. And two men, Michael Gove and Nick Gibb, were put in charge of the Education Department. Michael Gove was Education Secretary and Nick Gibb was Schools Minister, who's the one under, as it were. And they had been captured, both of them, in the 2 years prior to going into government, because it was pretty obvious that the Labour Party were going to be voted out and the Conservative Party needed a plan. They had been captured by the work of E.D. Hirsch. In particular, this idea of knowledge-rich education, that actually by learning important knowledge, that is how we can begin to bring to bear our minds on the world. And E.D. Hirsch's perspective, of course, is that children from all demographics need to know this vital knowledge, this powerful knowledge, you might call it, for the sake of the class that they're going to work in. And so if they go to a dinner party and they don't understand a reference from Macbeth, let's say, to refer back to that story, or they don't understand a reference from Hamlet, or they don't understand a reference from Pride and Prejudice, they're going to miss out on some really important cultural capital, and therefore they will not be able to break into that social circle. And so E.G. Hirsch's perspective is knowledge is worth knowing. Again, it's a utilitarian argument, but it's a more interesting utilitarian argument than you need it so you can get a good job. It's you need it because it's good for society, because it encourages social mobility and it encourages people being able to flourish in circles that they perhaps wouldn't have been. And so they changed our national curriculum in England, this is. And they made it far more rigorous, and they made it far more leaning toward some of the hallmarks of the classical education in the US. So thinking about phonics. In England, phonics is ubiquitous. Nobody in England does not teach phonics as the science of reading. Similarly, we have the same idea of mastery curricula for mathematics. So we would very much move from concrete to pictorial to abstract, and that would be the mode of learning for mathematics ubiquitously across English schools. And it had a profound impact. England was 23rd, 22nd, somewhere around there in the PISA tables, and is now 7th or 8th in the PISA tables for reading and mathematics. Wow. And so it had this big shift, which is really, really quite stark and impressive. And Michael Gove and Nick Gibb deserve an awful lot of credit for the work they did there. In fact, I would say it's probably the only thing that the Conservative Party did well whilst they were in government. But that's, again, probably a conversation for another time.
Right.
And meanwhile, Wales and Scotland watched England do this and decided to do the exact opposite.
Interesting.
And so whilst England was trying to lean toward a more traditional, we might call it traditional, we wouldn't call it classical, but we might call it traditional, way of understanding how to educate. The teacher is the expert at the front of the class. There are certain things that we need to, certain items of knowledge that we need to teach in order for people to move around the world and move into different social spheres. Wales and Scotland went, no, we think that the teacher should be a guide on the side. And we think that the progressive idea of whole word learning, whole word reading, and we think that, in fact, I'll give you an anecdote for this who might be helpful. Not too long ago, I was speaking to a primary school teacher in Wales. She teaches what I think would be second grade for you.
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling me that at the beginning of every term, the curriculum that she's mandated to teach requires her to gain from the pupils the things they want to learn. And then she has to teach skills through the things that the pupil want to learn for the rest of that year. That is the stark comparison. And so we've seen in real time the distinction between what that kind of education does for children and what was happening in England does. And of course, England has gone up the PISA rankings significantly, and Wales has fallen down significantly.
Yeah, I mean, what you're really describing is really just, it's just child-centered learning. Again, the teacher is displaced as a guide to the child's own self-discovery. So that is, it is a very, it's certainly known here in the U.S. as a potential and attractive to many idea, which seems very reasonable. But obviously, you lose everything in the traditional form of education. Yes, keep going.
And it's been a fascinating thing because this is Michael, the way Michael Gove would describe it, I should say Lord Gove, he has been elevated to the House of Lords. Lord Gove would describe it, and he'd say the gold standard of any scientific test or any scientific trial is to get twins. Because, of course, that mitigates and controls for a number of different variables. And if you can do a twin study, you've probably got as strong a evidence case as you can because you've been able to control for so many genetic variables. We have had a twin study with England and Scotland in how to
That's
do
fascinating.
Education. We've seen education. The impact of a child-centric education compared to not. And we now, the evidence is in, right? The case is closed from that study. And so it's been this really interesting moment in our history. Now, that said, of course, you started this by saying how far we are from classical education. That has been driven by a relentless desire for outcomes, which I think was important because the outcomes were so poor, but it has created a frenetic nature to the way that schools are that I think is at times inhumane. Not in all our schools, and I want to be really clear that I'm not talking about every single school in England, but certainly a majority. And that was one of the things I mentioned that I couldn't name, that Andrew Kern brought out and named, that I had felt uncomfortable about in the schools that I was working in, and that he was able to articulate. And I think, yes, that's it. We are doing this in an inhumane pace and a relentlessness that is not good for these children. So that's one of the things. But another one is the idea of Christian schooling. We're fortunate and blessed that schools in England and Wales and Scotland, over half of them are formally run by the church, whether it's the Church of England or the Catholic Church. More than 50% of our schools are run by those institutions, at least in name. And the reality, of course, is that in practice, that has fallen by the wayside. And so we have this large amount of so-called Christian education that actually isn't. And one of the other things then that I think is something that has really been resting on my heart, weighing heavy, is who are the people who are teaching, not just what are we teaching, not just how are we teaching, but who is teaching. And that again is one of the significant things and shifts that I know, you know, I can see on the news that there's not a story goes, not a day goes by where I don't see somewhere on, say, social media about, usually it's from libs of TikTok, about a teacher in a public school and the kind of character that a teacher in the public school in the US is. Mm-hmm. And similarly here, we have the same equivalent. And one of the things, of course, that a classical education would stand for is that we have virtuous and wise people standing in front of our students, because they are forming their character and they should be modeling what it is that can be formed, just as we've spoken about in the first part, my father was doing with me as a child. And so there is a real lack of men and women of integrity and of wisdom and of virtue in our schools because of the impetus, and I suppose you could call it the long march through the institutions.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great, that has a great been phrase.
That has been a real miss, I think, from where we are now. And again, a big part of what we're trying to do in starting up our schools.
It's interesting. And I think as you're telling this story, often thinking of it now, switching over to think about the church, often in the US here, we talk about, you know, what's coming in the next 10 years here in the US is what's already in place in the Europe and in the UK. And the schools, as you're describing them, are very similar here in many ways in terms of both the complete loss of the anchor point of anything that might have been Christian in so it's a lot in name only, and then sort of the politicization and even the complete misunderstanding of even the goals of education to the point of now really grossly misserving students and not having teachers, as you're describing, because it is an apprenticing process. So who are these people your children are with all day? So it's quite a cascading list of problems here that you've described.
One of the things that sort of sealed the deal for me with classical education was in February of this year, I and some colleagues of mine who are on this journey with me came to visit some schools. We did a little tour down from Wichita in Kansas all the way down to Austin, Texas, visiting various schools. And I've been fortunate enough in my previous job to visit a number of English schools. And at every single one, I would always sort of take a child aside, especially post the Andrew Kern epiphany. Can we call it that? I don't know if he'd feel comfortable with me calling it that, but we'll call it that.
He'd probably be very honored. Yes.
is taking a child aside and saying, "What school for? Why are you here?" Just to see if anybody in these schools is articulating something akin to more than get a good job or get good qualifications or go to university. And not a single one.
I'm assuming these are typically middle older students that you're asking this to?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Usually sort of 13 to 18 year olds.
So you're on this tour in the US and you're asking the question, what are you hearing?
Right. So now I'm on this tour in the US and I'm asking the question, and I'm hearing, I'll tell you three that really stuck out because I asked a number. The first was a young girl who we asked this question of a room we were, the school organized a meet for three of us and a number of their students over lunch. And we asked the question of the room and there were some great answers. There was a couple off the top of my head. There was to learn more about who Jesus is and become more like him. Okay, great. Good. I like that a lot.
You can't improve that answer by much.
Yes. Yes. It's like, you know, the joke around the Sunday school kid who says, "I know the answers, feels like the answer's Jesus, but it's like that's the answer to everything." Another one that said, to understand more about who I am through the work that I'm doing in my school, which I thought was great too. But the one that was the most profound for me in this context was this girl came up to us after. She was in tears and she said, "My father died over the summer. Why am I at this school? What's school for? Well, this school has been like another home for me, and it has wrapped itself around me, and it's prayed for me, and it's cared for me. And that's what the school is for. It's for building a community like that." And I just thought, not one of the answers that I've had from a school in England would have been anything like any of those answers. And sure, you can't improve to become more like Christ, but there's something powerful to a young girl telling you her story and describing the impact that the institution to which she goes to learn has had on her. And she clearly does not hate school. And she clearly is not begrudging of being forced to sit and do Latin. No, she's insanely grateful for the institution that cared for her. And that for me is why what's school for is to care for young people. It's for more than that, but it is for that.
Well, that's well said. It's beautiful. It reminds me so often of this statement I hear from parents that I was looking for a school for my child and I found a community for my family. And that need to really lock arms and raise our children together in this moment is so critical. I want to take another break and come back. And all of this is a great lead up to your own story of creating, two schools here.
I'm here with my friend Joanna really, Hensley, head of Lower School
brought
Wilson
back
Academy,
to life this great
to tell you about their exciting new program. Maybe you already know about Wilson
about
Academy. We talk about
also
Wilson
just
all
have
the time
a chance
on
for
Facebook
you to share
Live.
Just some words of encouragement both to parents
really
and to teachers.
And helpful online
classical
Christian
in many cases
education
on their own journey as you've described yours.
Courses
so we'll take a break and be
students
right
in grades 3-12. But what you may not know is that Wilson Hill is now offering a rich early learning program they call Forma for students in K through second grade. I'm here with Joanna. Joanna, tell us more.
Oh, thanks, Davies. Forma is such a wonderful way to begin a lifelong love of learning.
You know, we talk often about the cautions of technology, so let's just go ahead and get this out of the way. Are you encouraging kindergartners to be on Zoom all the time? Is that what this is?
Absolutely not, Davies. Forma does not involve putting five-year-olds on Zoom. Forma is a program that gives to parents valuable guidance from an experienced mentor teacher who walks them through a carefully curated curriculum for teaching reading, math, nature study, and enrichment like picture study and music, all within a like-minded, encouraging community.
I love what you guys are doing, especially for children in those younger ages. How can folks learn more about what you're doing with Forma?
They can visit our website, wilsonhillacademy.com/Forma, Forma.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Joanna.
Every school year tells a story, but the quieter pages often go unread. A science experiment that sparks wonder, a teacher guiding perseverance, moments parents long to hear. Zipcast brings those stories to light. Each 10 to 12 minute episode blends local updates from your school with wisdom from national parenting and education experts that addresses the questions parents long to have answered. Nearly 100 schools are using Zipcast this year, and fall or winter can be the perfect time to begin. Learn more at zipcast.media. Zipcast, encouraging you on the go with what you need to know.
Jamie, I wish we had time to hear all of your discoveries as you're making this pilgrimage back across the pond here in the U.S. to see the fruit of classical Christian education. Obviously, it had an impact on you. What happened next? Do you go back to the U.K. and what do you do?
We sat, it was a group of five of us that came over to the US, and we sat in Ellen Shuknecht's front room the penultimate night of being in Austin. And we formed a Fellowship for Classical Learning. And the Fellowship for Classical Learning is an organization that will seek to set up and run classical Christian schools across England and Wales. And we have started that with two. We are starting our first two over the course of the next 18 months. Our first in London, in Westminster, called the Fountain Christian School, and our second in Cardiff, called St. Anselm's School. And that organization was birthed out of this trip together. So yes, pilgrimage is exactly right. We then flew back home, and FCL was born. We are now engaging in all of the fun and exciting, and I don't know if you can hear the sarcastic tone in my voice, parts of starting a school, like fundraising,
quotes,
and
air quotes
policies
around fun, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But also we're engaging with prospective parents and prospective teachers, and we have had some remarkable moments in this story already. We are not even 7-8 months, what is it, since February? Yeah, 9 months old. And we've had seen an amazing work of God in what we're doing already. And it's really exciting at a time when it can feel incredibly daunting to be doing something new, particularly in the UK. You may have seen, American listeners may have seen, that VAT on school fees has been enacted by this current government. And of course, that makes us the only nation in the world that taxes education, which doesn't make starting a school easier. You may also have seen that only 5% of our nation goes to church once a month, which doesn't make starting a Christian school particularly easy. And yet, there is a real sense of excitement that we have, because we really do feel that God has formed something in us that is His, and that we are doing His work rather than our own. And that's a really exciting thing to be a part of.
Well, share just a, I know there's, again, this is, there's so many elements to this, but I know when we talked over lunch, you talked about the VAT, which not everyone may be familiar. We tend to, if we've gone over as a tourist, you're always prompted at the airport to turn in your receipts to get back your VAT, you know, this tax. It's sort of a laid on top of everything for those who live within the country. But you, the numbers, is it 5 million pounds? It's a pretty daunting number, right, that you guys have to raise in order to even offset the burden of that tax. Am I getting that right?
There's two things here. So the first is the way that the tax works is it levies 20% on any fees. So of course that makes anything that we do for a parent 20% more expensive, which either we have to swallow as an organization, or we have to pass on to parents, which makes us more unaffordable. And so there are two things. One, we have to raise some capital to fund that gap so that we don't have to pass it on to parents, yes. But actually, the thing you're mentioning, the desire from us is what we're trying to do is renew a deeply British way of doing education. The reason that we have mass education in the West, in part, not in full, but in part, is because wealthy Christians and the church endowed schools throughout the Middle Ages and slightly before to educate the poor in the liberal arts. If you look at our elite private schools, so Eton, Winchester, Harrow, St. Paul's, they were started because the local church and local wealthy men wanted to educate the poor, to love the Lord, and in the liberal arts. They were done for free. And of course, the rich families had their private tutors. So they didn't need to send their kids to the school. But these schools ended up being much better than the private tutors. And so the rich families said, well, can we send our child here, please? Because they're doing a better job than what our tutor's doing. But our desire is not just to renew that methodology of teaching. What is the intention of school? Not just to answer that question the same way, the purpose of school being to love the Lord by pursuing the liberal arts, but also to renew the funding mechanism behind that. We think that these schools should be accessible to all. So our desire is to create an endowment fund that can mean that no parent pays more than they are able to afford to send their child to our school. And again, to be clear, that's not a new thing. That is a deeply old thing that we would be renewing. And if we're going to renew the purpose, why not renew the mechanism too?
What's such helpful perspective, and to realize too, just at face value, the task before you, the calling before you is so monumental that only God could make this happen. And I love that you are not shying away from that, because we were talking during the break. I mean, so many people that are listening right now to this podcast are in environments where either they're considering starting a classical Christian school, or they have already started one and now they are trying to really sort out these monumentally difficult objectives, whether it's just how do we get property, how do we acquire the resources we need to really get this up and running. And so I love your tenacity and your vision and your encouragement. In the few minutes we have left, just it's kind of in that vein of encouragement, as you think about those who are listening, first who are parents, I'd love just for you to speak to them, especially if they're maybe like you were on the journey trying to decide, is it worth making the leap? This is such, there's so many costs to stepping outside what's normal, including the mockery maybe of neighbors going, what have you done? Why would you put your kids in this strange cult school, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What words of encouragement would you have to just parents first?
Yeah, I think two things. The first, neither of which are mine, of course, because there's nothing new under the sun. The first would, I think, be cribbed from Jessica Houghton Wilson, who I saw a blog of hers that was talking about real life. I think one of the things that parents, at least in my experience, are scared of or concerned about, maybe scared is too strong, maybe it's not a fear, but maybe it's just a hesitancy, is I want my child to experience real life. You know, why would I put them in a closed institution where they don't get to experience real life? And Jessica's pushback to that, which I found so compelling, is what is real life? Is real life church on a Sunday morning where we get to experience the presence of God with our brothers and sisters? Is real life eternity? where we will get to do that in perpetuity. Well, if that is the case, then surely real life will be an institution where your child is doing that on a daily basis. In England, we have 20,000 hours in education. I think in the US, it's more like 18. But real life would be those things for those 20,000 hours. And so trying to reframe the way of thinking about real life from what the world says it is to perhaps what we might say it is as Christians, I think that's the first thing I'd say. And that has been a really helpful rubric for me. And then the second one would be...
Great question.
The second would be... It seems to me that, and there are various data points on this, you know, you may have come across The Quiet Revival, which is a thesis by Justin Brierley, who's a British podcaster who's written a book about this too. It seems to me that Christianity is becoming cool again. There is a really interesting phenomenon taking place where public intellectuals, public influencers are at the very least seeing the value of Christianity in society. They may not buy the metaphysics, they may not profess Christ with their mouth and believe him with their heart, but they at least see the value of it. And so the second thing I'd say would be, now's the time to show that. Now's the time to really push into saying, do you know, actually, true things work. The reason there's value to Christianity is because the truth does actually set us free. And the reason there's value to Christianity is because that works for who we are as humans. And so now is the time to begin to show that and to commit to that with our children, to say this is a thing that we want to stand in the gap and pursue, because we want to show how important Christ is to me as an individual, to my family as a family unit, but to my society more broadly. And I think that more people who are able to do that, the more cool Christianity will be. I mean, again, I spoke about my childhood growing up. I was in 10th grade when Dawkins published The God Delusion. And so that was all the rage, as you can probably imagine, for every 16, 17-year-old who's reading that book, that who fancies himself as an intellectual. Everybody loves that book. I mean, if we're being honest, it's an incredibly poorly written book that's really quite laughable in its attempt to disprove the existence of God. But that's not the case anymore. What are those kids doing now? They're not reading Dawkins. Or if they are, they're hearing him say, I'm a cultural Christian. And that means something very different. So now's a great time to be getting into this, despite how hard things might look.
Well, I think I've just final comment on that, because I want to get your impression of your thoughts to educators as well. But I do think you're right. There's a kind of a pendulum swing that we've gone so far over rejecting God and looking at the fallout in our culture today. And I think voices like Charlie Kirk's and others have sort of helped frame the contrast, and now have only added even more fuel to this determination to we've tasted and seen, and we don't want that anymore. We see a lot of that with technology, where more and more younger families are not needing to be convinced that giving a smartphone to their child is not a really great idea, or putting one on an iPad for entertainment. That you don't have to say that anymore. They're coming to school saying, we know we want the school that doesn't do that and doesn't encourage that. So there isn't, that's encouraging. You're right. I think there's a wave that we need to lean in on. What would you say then, just in the final words here, to encourage educators or even entrepreneurs as yourself, looking at the problem saying this needs to be addressed, and I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I feel called to do it. And whether the doing it is starting a school or serving in a classroom, what words of encouragement would you have?
I think the first thing I'd say would be, we're not trying to recreate a specific period in time in what we're trying to do here. Don't feel under pressure to be like the schools of the 1850s or the schools that Alcuin set up. We are a part of a tradition that has developed over time and is still going, and we are renewing that tradition. And so my first thing to encourage teachers is, and this is squarely the bracket that I fall into, which is why I feel passionate about it. My education was entirely unremarkable. Yes, I was blessed to have a father who did know his stuff, but my education myself was entirely unremarkable. It is only really in later life that I really started reading. So my first encouragement would be, don't feel under pressure to be as well-read as you perceive the teachers of the 1850s to be, or to be as articulate as Lewis is, because those names will get thrown around a lot and it can feel quite pressurizing. I certainly feel inadequate comparing myself to those people, as I'm sure many of us do. Mm. My first encouragement is, you're not trying to do that. You're standing in that tradition. You're learning from it. You're learning to embody it. Don't let that be an inhibitor for you. And again, I'm speaking to myself here, not just to listeners. And the second thing would be to say, I'm yet to meet anybody who, when we articulate what a classical Christian education is about, goes, oh, no, not for me. No, thank you. And so be bold in articulating what you're doing. Don't be hesitant about it. I think, again, there it can be this reticence around a number of things when we're talking about classical education, about talking about goodness, truth, and beauty. Don't get lost in the weeds by all accounts, but do articulate those things powerfully with real conviction about why it is that those are the things that we should be pursuing in our schools, because it speaks volumes. And again, you mentioned the power of story. Do it with a story. Tell people about children that you have seen changed from this, and do it with boldness, because by doing that, we will invite more people into that story. That's what's happened to me. That's what's happened to countless others that I know. And so let's do that.
Well, it's everything you have said has been so encouraging, Jamie. And I think very affirming and confirming, because so often it feels like we are literally off on an island. and we wonder if this is just some strange trend or something that we've fallen into or something out of desperation, because we see things are broken. And clearly it is a rediscovery of things that God has implemented and established for centuries, that we're now stepping back into that history and reframing truth, goodness, and beauty into the lives of the next generation. So thank you for your courageous work. I look forward to interviewing you again in the near future and hearing how all this manifests itself, because certainly the UK, England and Wales in particular need what you're doing. And I'm so grateful for your servant leadership. Thank you for telling your story today. Jamie, if anybody wants to follow the work you're doing and even just be there in prayer support, how can they learn more about your work and your schools?
Yeah, you can find us on if you Google the Fellowship for Classical Learning, fellowshipforclassicallearning.co.uk, you'll find us there. You'll find our two schools. You'll see more of who we are, the rest of the team. You can find our school websites there, and you can sign up to our newsletters as well. We really do covet your prayers. Whilst I am relentlessly optimistic about what God is doing, the reality is also that it is going to be a hard work. It is going to be very much like rebuilding a wall. And so we need to, we really covet your prayers. So thank you for the opportunity to chat and to solicit them.
Most certainly.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Basecamp Live. Be sure to check out our website, basecamplive.com, for more than 8 years of timeless episodes that you'll find helpful and encouraging, as well as the helpful resources offered on our partners page. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of our partners like the Herzog Foundation. See you back next week.